Bill 5029, which is a piece, where the Office of Alcohol and Drug is a piece in that particular budget. And what I would like to do, we do have like about 3 pages of people signed up, and I don't know if any of you were here yesterday, but we had a lot of people in the audience yesterday too. What I'd like to do is if you have written testimony, you can hand that in as well. But if you've got a couple pages of written testimony, what I'd like to do is try to get as many people to testify today as possible. So if you'd limit your comments to about 2 minutes each. And if I stop you, I want you to realize that I'm not being rude to you. I'm helping you not be rude to the people who are waiting to come up and testify, the other individuals that are signed up. So with that, I will just, and what I think I'll do is I'll call up three at a time, or because there are 3 chairs up there, so and you feel that you can sit fairly easily there. So I will call up Steve Carmichael, Gene Phelps, and Judge Daryl Larson, excuse me. And the rest of the committee will be along soon. Let's go again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This turns out to be a Lane County delegation, but it's not really designed to be.
See? Have to walk in the room at the same time.
I'm Steve Carmichael. I'm the director of the Juvenile Department in Lane County and the president of the Juvenile Department Directors Organization for the state, representing the 36 juvenile departments. Alcohol and drugs are a big issue for us to deal with. We have lots of juveniles that are committing crimes and that are brought to us for detention and supervision. When we do surveys of the juveniles on probation or detained, we always find about 75% to 80% have serious drug problems. So the treatment of those juveniles for their substance abuse problems is absolutely critical. We know that when we look at the risk factors to identify who are the high-risk kids, who are the kids who are going to commit the major crimes and multiple crimes, substance abuse is a major risk factor. So it's a critical issue. And we also know that, fortunately, the treatment works for those juveniles. Juveniles that get good drug and alcohol treatment can succeed and do succeed. We have, in Lane County, I'm more familiar with the programs there because that's my own county, but other counties have similar experiences. We have a couple of residential programs. Willamette Family Service runs one for girls and Looking Glass for boys. Both of those programs take juveniles who have extensive criminal backgrounds, and they work with them for several months, and we have more than a 90% success rate with juveniles that come out of that program and do not commit another crime. So we look at their sort of rap sheet or their list of criminal offenses going in. It's very long, and when they get out, we've tracked those juveniles for 3 and 4 years afterward. They don't commit more crimes, and they stay off drugs. So we know treatment works. We know it's critical. So across the state, we support this.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. My name is Cheryl Matt-Gennady. I'm representing Gene Phelps for the Relief Commissioner in Eugene. First, I think I'd like to tell you what the Relief Commissioner is, give you a little background on our alcohol and drug program.
Okay.
After that, the Relief Commissioner is a therapeutic preschool. We have about 70 staff that deal with early intervention services for preschool-age children. They're the most high risk for child abuse and neglect in the state or in the county. And we've been replicated in Portland, Salem, Cottage Grove. Okay. About in 1984, the National Commission for Child Abuse and Neglect held an yearly meeting. And the hot topic of conversation at that meeting was child abuse and neglect and alcohol and drug use, and nobody had any answers. Came back to the state of Oregon, Governor Goldschmidt wrote in a line item for any of the parents that attended the relief nursery would be funded for alcohol and drug treatment services. And that was for a period of 1 year. During that year, no one took advantage of that. so that wasn't the answer. The next year, the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect put out federal grant to try and work on this problem, because they were seeing that that was the one problem that was preventing any major move in the incidence of child abuse and neglect. And the Accessing Success program came into being, and it was then a collaboration, and that's the Alcohol and Drug Program for the Relief Ministry. What they did, some really unusual things back then. They sat parents down and asked them what services they needed to help them stay clean and sober. And they said things like, we need anger management services. We need some parenting classes that focus on parents who are addicted to alcohol and drugs, because there's a whole another set of problems there, as I'm sure you've heard in your testimony. They needed someone to talk to that knew where they were coming from. So with me today are part of our staff, peer support, and I thought that they were going to get a chance to talk, and I'm sorry that time is so limited, because that's where the real message is about why these services work. What I can tell you is that we have a phenomenal success rate by embedding the alcohol and drug services into early intervention services. At the time of intake, clients who had been participating in our services and intake into the Relief Nursery, 17 months later, in an evaluation study that was done, 99% of those people were still clean and sober. And I'm sure you know the stats for treatment.
How much later?
17 months.
Okay, 99%. That's impressive.
Mm-hmm. About 87% are termed successful after starting the program today and completing the program, which can go up to, as long as they have a preschool age child, they can stay in our program. That's up to 10 years for some people. The thing is that when Accessing Success came into being, it didn't work for 2 years. We went to Washington and said, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to change? And we discovered that the philosophies of alcohol and drug treatment and the philosophy of early intervention treatment services are like polar. And we've managed to bring those together, and those are our success rates. So we're here to support this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, my name is Beryl Larson. I'm a circuit judge in Wayne County, Eugene, and I've submitted some written testimony, so I'm going to skip parts of that.
Okay.
But I think you'll see on the top of that that I come here probably wearing a number of hats, and I want to say that I'm probably speaking for all of those positions that I hold, because they're all consistent with the message I want to deliver here today. I'd like to say that after 28 years as either a prosecutor or as a judge, I thought it might be helpful to you if I were to share some of my real-world perspective and acquired knowledge about drug and alcohol addictions and their policy implications for public safety, children, and taxpayers' money. First, I should confess that my approach to public issues tends to be progressive in the sense that I'm always on the lookout for and optimistic about finding more successful ways to get the job done. But I'm fiscally conservative in the sense that I am reticent to spend taxpayers' money in ways that don't have a provable and positive payoff. Given my professional origins as a prosecutor and now as a judge, this philosophical bent is particularly strong when it comes to the issue of public safety. During the last 10 years, the state of Oregon has done little to increase investment in legal dollars in drug and alcohol treatment, but has made enormous investments in jails and prisons, and I footnoted my testimony to give you some ideas about that. Despite more than a 350% increase in spending on state prisons, there was only a 1.5 per 10,000 population decrease in violent crime arrests between 92 and 96. While we only spend $19.15 a day to educate a child in the Eugene public school system, which I think is seen as a fairly decent school system, we spend $85 a day to keep a person in Wayne County jail. That's without any treatment. And $53.73 per day in the last biennium for prison space for inmates. A person with a public issues approach, not like mine, might fairly ask, are we substantially safer now than we were in 1992? And are we getting a significant return for every dollar spent of the taxpayers' money? Seems to me the answer is an emphatic no. Before I move on to how we could substantially improve public safety while also significantly improving criminal justice outcomes per dollar expended, I think it would be prudent to talk about how drugs and alcohol affect the Oregon equation. With funds from the Federal Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, or CSAT, Oregon recently conducted a comprehensive survey of the needs of Oregonians for alcohol and drug treatment. The study results demonstrated that there are over 133,000 Oregonians declared as, or classified as dependent on those substances and 120,000 people abusing drugs or alcohol. That's over a quarter of a million people in the state of Oregon alone. The most recent statewide substance abuse survey of students revealed that the use of drugs and alcohol by Oregon eighth graders is above the national average in all categories except amphetamines, and that'll change in a hurry, and that our eighth graders use inhalants at close to twice the national average and marijuana at levels half again as high as the national average. It's clear that alcohol and marijuana, from my perspective, at least over the time I've been doing what I do, are gateway drugs to what leads to other further substance abuse, multi-drug use, and subsequently crime. Adult arrestees consistently demonstrate that a pattern of drug and alcohol abuse dependence is in the range of 70% to 80%. Nearly 70% of revoked probationers are revealed to be experiencing substance abuse problems prior to their probation revocation. Due to the enactment of sentencing guidelines, nearly all offenders, except those who are convicted of violent offenses, are placed on some form of probation. There is far too little availability of treatment on demand, and except for in the case of drug courts, which are substantially different, there are far too little close supervision and monitoring to ensure that when treatment is ordered, that it's actually carried out. In short, drug abuse is driving the criminal justice system, and I would challenge anyone to find an opinion that's substantially different or any data that supports it. It is not exactly novel to tell you that Oregon cannot afford to spend precious public dollars on programs that don't work and which cost too much. Fortunately for public policymakers like yourself, there are some well-researched good news items on the radar screen. In 1996, researcher Dr. Michael Finnegan, Ph.D., completed a study for the Oregon Alcohol and Drugs Office designed to determine whether treatment works, and if so, what are the cost savings that may accrue to the public. The results are quite astounding, but I can assure you are very consistent with my own experience. Dr. Finnegan examined treatment completers who were compared to a statistically matched and controlled group of persons receiving little or no treatment. He reviewed a period of 2 years prior and 3 years subsequent to treatment, and so as to remain on the very conservative end of the spectrum financially, measured only those costs which could be observed utilizing statewide databases. He found that outpatient treatment completers were arrested at a rate of 45% lower than the matched control group for the 3 years subsequent to treatment, that inpatient treatment completers were incarcerated at 70% lower than matched group, treatment completers received 65% higher wages than those not completing treatment, and that the use of food stamps was reduced by 66%, that open child welfare cases with FCF or CFD decreased by 50%, medical expenses were substantially lower for treatment completers, and this was not even counting unemployment savings, federal and state prison costs, institutional costs, intoxicated driver costs, business losses, drug-affected birth costs, and the presumed benefits from people who received treatment but really didn't complete, so they couldn't be included within that group. Mm-hmm. He concluded that for every tax dollar spent in Oregon, there is a $5.60 measurable amount in avoided expenses to other programs and services that are provided by the legislature. Having served as Wayne County's drug court judge for the past 4 years, I can tell you from firsthand experience that closely supervised treatment works, even though it's mandated. In fact, the mandate is one of the things that makes it work better. I can also tell you that since they're putting someone in custody or on probation without enforcing closely supervised drug and alcohol treatment, that the public is simply pouring money down a rat hole. Something to keep in mind is that this drug abusing population, about this substance abusing population, is they are no more responsible with their sexual habits than they are with your personal safety or your property. They usually have children. Unless we can efficiently and cost effectively teach these persons how to remain clean and sober, they will and are destroying the next generation of kids as they go. We do not have the luxury of waiting any longer to decide whether we should or shouldn't invest in treatment. Frankly, drug and alcohol treatment should be a no-brainer for any informed policymaker, regardless of political philosophy. And done correctly, treatment significantly reduces recidivism, reduces taxpayers' costs, increases earnings, and not to mention state coffers from tax money that's acquired because of that, decreases human suffering for addicts and their families while demonstrably improving public safety at far less cost than incarceration alone. I suggest that there are very few dollars that you're going to find in this legislative session that you decide to spend, which will return more per dollar on the investment in drug treatment. I unequivocally recommend that you approve the increase in support for drug treatment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Shields.
Yes, since I would take it to you wholeheartedly and endorse the governor's budget relative to $20 million for treatment, I have a question. If we can't get that $20 million out of the budget, what would you think about a beer wine tax dedicated to treatment? We have not raised that tax in 22 years, as you know.
Well, I won't fight it, but I'm not going to hold my breath until you get it through the legislation.
That's probably a good idea.
I don't look as good in blue as you might think.
You may need CPR.
Right.
Madam Chair? This is a question for staff. In the initial Senate budget, I think we set aside $18 million for enhanced alcohol and drug, and we thought we could pick up a $2 million match. Is that correct?
There's $2 million for federal funding on that.
And as I chair the Judiciary Committee, and we look at the different programs, and we had testimony this week from a gentleman who's now successful going through rehabilitation, but he commented he in his first 5 attempts he failed. And it's always surprising to me how many times with some individuals it takes. And in talking to counselors, at some point in their life, a light goes on and they either say, yeah, I've got to do this or I'm going to die, or something that motivates them at that point personally to say, this time I'm going to succeed. And the success rate in juvenile programs is even less, because juveniles, for the most part, think, at least that was that long ago, that was, you know, you're kind of bulletproof. You know, you can take care of this problem later on, or it's not really a problem. But the success rate in juvenile programs can be as low as 15%. So that is always distressing when you try to say, okay, how should we invest our money? Because normally you get a little better rate of return, more success than we seem to in the drug and alcohol area. But to some extent, that just shows you the seriousness of the problem and the addiction, but and the fact you have to have that continued commitment afterwards to make it successful. And the other problem is we don't have better programs or solutions right now.
Mm-hmm. Sherman, would you mind if I respond to that very briefly? I think one of the things that's very easily forgotten and neglected, and it certainly was by me for a long time until the job I've been doing for the last 4 years with the drug court, is that you forget that while a person is in treatment, there are dramatic public benefits to the fact that they're in treatment. And if the treatment is voluntary as opposed to mandated, you know, you can walk in, but you can walk out, which is one of the reasons why it goes from one time in treatment to 2 times in treatment to 3 times. And why at the average of 7 voluntary treatments it actually finally takes, I mean, statistically. But if it's mandated, and some of these programs are dealing with people who are mandated to the system, I can say our success rates are much, much higher, because they don't get walkouts. They're going to deal with it until they get it right, and I have the authority to make sure they do. That dramatically improves the value per dollar that you're spending on this. But I would like to say that there is actual value to the taxpayer and to all the systems that these people affect from the fact that somebody did voluntarily walk into a treatment facility and stayed with it, and they do tend to not relapse quite as hard and for not as long a period of time each time they're in treatment, even if it's voluntary.
Madam Chair, one final comment, and that was mentioned too by one of the providers, saying that even though they failed, and they may have failed more than once, for that 6 months that they were, or 3 months during the program, they weren't committing crimes, they were working, they were having some success. And as you say, when they come back the second time, your job might be a little easier. It's just hard to me.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, too, that the two kinds of statistics we were given today, both by Cheryl and yourself, are a little bit different than what we have been given at other times or what I have been given, because a success rate often is when you ask what criteria is used to determine success, and it is that the person basically completed the program, not that they were clean and sober for any length of time, but it's a completion. And it would be a no-brainer, as you say, if it really was verifiable that people were completing and clean and sober. But I have also heard in the issue regarding voluntary versus mandated that mandated didn't work. I've heard that in past years since I've been in the legislature. Over the last 5 years, I've actually heard that when you mandate it, you have less success. This person doesn't want to do it. They have to. It's like they're being told they have to, and where voluntary is supposed to be better. So I think there are some mixed messages and statistics and everything else and limited resources, of course. And if there really is a $5.50 savings to the state, what we need to do is go and capture that so that we can pay for that dollar of service that we would render to these folks.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. The problem is that without the dollars for treatment, you can't get to the $5.60. And that's why
it is. The Finnegan study is showing us that over past times, there should be some, because he did a study. He followed these people, and he named the areas where it made savings. So we ought to be able to go to those agencies right now, because he did the study, and he did the study that is tracking people within the state. So we should be able to find that. So that investment had been made, apparently, for him to do the study and find the success rate. So. Because there is money being spent now. There is money being spent now in alcohol and drugs. So it's not like it's a zero-sum game. So we should be able to track some of that and actually be able to make a savings.
Well, the policymaker ought to keep in mind that drug addiction is a chronic relapsing disease. You're never going to be totally rid of it. And I would never guarantee that somebody won't relapse.
Mm-hmm.
But the trade-off from a policy point of view is, do you want to spend the money on jails, or do you want to spend the money on treatment for a lot less money with a lot greater effect than all these other systems?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it comes down to, because these people are killing us in terms of their criminality, and they're mm-hmm. affecting all the rest of the points in the system. It's just a wiser investment,
mm-hmm.
with better outcomes. And the research is there now to demonstrate these outcomes.
Well, it's beginning to be there, and as I say, when the criteria is clearly defined, 17 or 18 months later, is that I will accept as a success. But completing a program, a 20-week program, is not success.
I don't think any of us at this table would want to ever accept that as a criteria.
But that is the criteria that many treatment those that provide treatment give as a success rate. So I just want you to know that in our notebook, when you ask the question, what is success? That is, if this person, it's not 20 weeks either, it's a 6-week program or something like that they completed. And that's where I think that we need to know clearly what are we saying is success. And believe me, I imagine we will hear today about some successes, and that's good. And we have heard from you folks already about the successes, and I have read the Finnegan report or had it come up in testimony prior. So we'll continue to look into that, and I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ross,
very briefly, do you have written testimony from the relief nursery?
Yes, I do. I was going to leave it as I walked past.
Okay, because I think that that does respond to some of the chair's concern. I think you had data about the completion and then the results of your successful completers 18 months later.
Correct.
Good. Okay. Thank
you. Actually stated that in the testimony.
That's why I went.
I stopped her, and it was pretty impressive.
Thank you.
Okay, the next panel. Carl Sundberg and daughter Shannon and Tanya Pritt and Dan Cochran. It looks like you'll have to bring an extra chair, maybe. Is there a loose chair?
That one doesn't look good. One of our man rabbits.
Very talking and sleeping.
Come on, guys.
Okay.
Madam Chair, representatives and senators, I am in awe to be able to come and speak before this panel today. My primary job in life is being a dad. What I do for a living is I'm in my 20th year of working in a school system. I have been an award-winning employee. I've gotten awards from scouting. I've gotten awards from sheriff's offices. I've gotten every kind of award a person can get. And I know you're rushing me, but I'm...
No, I'm not rushing you.
Oh.
I need your name for the record.
Oh, Carl Sundberg. Carl Sundberg, sorry. I always thought of myself as being the perfect dad. I mean, I taught religion in church and did everything you're supposed to do. I was always at home. I'm not the kind of guy that ever went to a bar and got drunk and came home and set a bad example for my kids and all of that kind of good stuff. I've worked with every kind of kid I can think of. I've been there, straight across the board. And the concept that I would have a daughter wired out on heroin while living in my household was something I would have taken every member at this panel to task at in the most violent way, because it just couldn't happen in my home. My wife and I have only been married 26 years. We're still on our honeymoon. We have a wonderful marriage. Everything about my household works very, very well. And what happens is, you see, somebody didn't notice. We care a lot about making certain that kids' shoes fit when we send them to school, but we don't care if the schools don't fit the kids, or if the neighborhoods don't fit the kids, or if lots of things in the community don't fit the kids. And I have to tell this panel, my daughter has been in counseling since she was 5 years old, because we've always had some challenges with her. No one picked up on the fact that she had a serious disorder until we got her in treatment this last time. I've spent thousands of dollars on therapy and treatment for things that weren't even drugs. The fact is, and the point I need to make here, which is extremely important to make to this panel, is this. I hear you folks refer to surveys and treatment and successes, and I hear really clear something that I could, too, support. My daughter was in an in-house treatment program for about 2 weeks, and then she was in a couple of these once or twice a week programs where she got some counseling. And all I can say to that is, whoopee chimp. These are the programs my insurance company wanted me to go to. These weren't the programs my kid needed. These are the programs people were willing to pay for. These weren't the programs my kids needed. Your surveys are just full of tainted information. And it wasn't tainted by parents who thought their kids were done. It wasn't tainted by people who thought they were doing good, bad research. It was tainted by the fact that the front end was dictated by insurance companies limiting what you could get for children who really needed some special attention. Finally, on December 31st, 1998, my child started a program that has lasted 4 months. I took basically a 12-year-old child to a treatment facility and brought home a young woman. 4 months. Not 4 weeks, not 2 weeks, not four times a week for 10 weeks, not let's go and talk about it for an hour. I'm talking 4 months of intensive, incredibly loving, caring care, and probably one of the finest drug treatment facilities in the nation. And it happens to be here in Oregon. I'm real proud of that. Real proud of that. They hide it down in Albany, but it's a real wonderful program. It's not where a lot of kids need it, in the Eugenes and the Portlands and the Salems, I might add.
What's the name of the program?
Guest House. And I want you to know, I hate psychiatrists and counselors and all the people who do all this stuff, because I'm a broadcast engineer, and doggone it, man, I get seconds to fix something, not lifetimes like they get. I have thousands of models to work on, not two units like they have. I don't see where these treatment programs shouldn't be better than they are, but I can tell you something. I've hated every psychiatrist, counselor, person I've ever come encounter with, because I just can't understand this huge amount of inability to have success until I got to Yes House. I'm afraid, other than the ugly building and the fact that it needs paint and the fact that it needs some maintenance attention from time to time, there's nothing wrong with Yes House. It's incredible. It's full of tomorrow's leaders. These kids that are in these programs aren't druggy kids. You get them cleaned up for a couple of days and get them in a program where they start to work every hour of every day. No television, nothing. They just go and go and go and go and go. They come home and start counseling families. I want you to know that what you're voting on here today is extremely dear to Dad and Mom here, because we're not people who came from that drug scene. I'm old enough that nobody that I went to high school did drugs.
Carl, how did you finally get her into Yes House? How did that actually happen?
It was an absolute war with my insurance company. And in fact, part of her stay was paid by state funds, or she wouldn't have made it through the program. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was willing to go to bat and sell everything I own. This is my baby here. I have three other children. One of them is a B student at the University of Oregon. This is not a rotten household this child came from. This is a rotten world this child lived in. And we are not being successful funding cops and funding judges and funding all kinds of jails. We're not being successful. Until you kill the demand, drugs will continue to be one of the most profitable industries in every state that it exists in. If somebody would have given me $1 billion in high school to go get something that was illicit, I'm afraid I'd have gone home that day as a poor child. Today, any kid on any campus can buy you anything you want. And in that atmosphere, the only answer to that kind of a circumstance is a drug treatment program that's, one, quick, two, effective, and three, long-term and extremely intensive. When you start looking at surveys that are based upon success rates, where people are only getting one or two counseling sessions a week for 10 weeks, or in a treatment facility for 10 days, I'm going to tell you something. You're looking at tainted information. Put them in a program for 4 months. Check the people who've been in Yes House. Mm-hmm. Check the kids in Yes House. I dare say you're not going to find 15%.
Madam Carr, did you have a question?
I do have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
How long was your daughter in Yes House? Does Yes House have a certain time that they help a person, or what dictates how long they should be there?
What dictates, from what I can tell, and I can't speak for Yes House because I'm just a dad. The lady who runs the place can speak in a moment, but I can tell you from a dad's point of view, they told me when I told them when my 18 days of insurance was up and I was going to take Shannon out whether she was ready to come home or not, they said, wait a second, no, that isn't the way we do business. The children go home when they're ready to go home. We'll figure out some way to take care of them.
Shannon, did you want to say a few things?
Yes, I would.
Your name is Shannon?
My name is Shannon, yeah. I've gone through another inpatient treatment center before, this one in Albany, Yes House. And I was there for about 2.5 weeks, and I was convinced that I was ready to leave, and they released me on behalf of my insurance, which didn't cover any more. And the night I got home, I relapsed, and it did me no good. And 3 years later, attending outpatient programs throughout my city, which did no good, I got strung out on heroin for about 3.5 months, and then through the despondence of what point my life had gotten to, I asked for help, and I left a letter for my parents, and I got sent to Yes House after I went through detox for 5 days. Through Yes House, I've been clean for about 5 months now, and it's the longest period of 5 years that I have been clean, and through the tools of the treatment program, it has done remarkable and dramatic results for me, and I can't even begin to explain all the things that I've gotten back because of the treatment program. And at one point, I believed that I was terminal and that I would be the way that I was or die the way that I was.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, Shannon. What was different about Yes House from the others? Why do you think there was good results?
Well, for one, you couldn't BS anybody there. They really went into what was going on with you, and they strongly encourage you to let out what it is that is going on with you, and primarily that's what makes you sick and what feeds your addiction and causes you to result into drug abuse, and sometimes you don't even need a reason to use. But it's just everyone there was very understanding and caring and loving and didn't really treat you like you were bad and need to be punished, but like you were sick and needed help.
Senator Yee. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you mind if we ask you how old are you, Shannon?
I'm 18.
Well, we appreciate hearing that you are clean for 5 months now, and we hope you stay clean. My question is, do you think we should mandate alcohol and drug treatment, or should we wait until the youth is willing? I mean, shall we leave it voluntary, or do you think it should be mandated?
I feel that it should be mandated. I think that people should be pushed into drug and treatment. If it's a good treatment center like Yes House, then over a period of a month or so, you start tearing down the masks, and it really does bring out what's really wrong with you. And I think that voluntarily, it's good to voluntarily go into a treatment center like myself, because then you already know that you have a problem. But most people that go in there court ordered, or because they have a probation officer, they don't feel they have a problem. But eventually they start tearing down the masks. And I know one of my friends who has also gone through Yes House, who went in there thinking he didn't have a problem, came out incredibly, like, so much better than when he came in, and he's been sober for a period of time now.
Follow-up, Senator Yee, I'm here. So if the program is mandated and if the youth is not ready, then he or she would walk out in the middle of the program. But on the other hand, if we mandate it, it helps a person stay on the program. So you mean, as far as you can see, it should be mandated?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Very
much. I've seen dozens of kids come into Yes House, and all of them were like, my daughter had been at one point, surly, fighting, I'm not, there's nothing wrong with me, yada, yada, yada. And the remarkable change that occurs in a couple of months in these kids. They go from way out here to sweet, kind, wonderful, everything they should have been to begin with kids. And it's better than watching the flowers start to develop, because these kids who come in are they don't have an idea where they're at. And this program, I don't know how you could copy this program statewide, but if you could copy this program statewide, you could put about 12 houses in Eugene, you could put about 5 here in Salem, from what I can tell, about 20 in Portland, and about 10 in Medford, and you just about start to put a dent in this abuse that we have here. The program they have there is absolutely unbelievable. I've seen kids come in with a chip on their shoulder so big it wouldn't fit in this building and leave hugging their moms and dads.
Oh, Mom, I have another question.
Okay, Senator.
Can we make it quick?
Okay, we've got 3 pages.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand follow-up program is also very important after treatment. Mm-hmm. So are you mandated to stay with a follow-up program?
Yes.
After treatment?
I don't have to, but voluntarily I do want to go to an outpatient program.
Mm-hmm. For how long?
A year, 6 months,
mm-hmm.
a year.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Shannon. Dan?
Yeah. Dan Cochran?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm academic aide and treatment aide at the Yes Health facility. First thing, I guess I would just like to clarify, are you guys just using one study for
no.
your, no, this is based on several. Okay, based on all of these studies, are they based on inpatient as well as outpatient treatment, or just inpatient?
Variety.
Variety. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I would just like to say, as to that fact, outpatient is typically very unsuccessful. Yes, out. Does mostly, I think, almost entirely inpatient work and then the follow-up care. I'd like to say that at our house, I've been working there 9 months now. Our success rate is incredible, and I think this is in large part due to the fact that we don't have a set time limit. Tell the kids you have to get clean in 28 days, and then you're out the door. Because one of our sayings is, or the kids' saying is, fake it till you make it. You know, you got 28 days to do it, you're in and out of this program, it's really not a problem. If you know you've got to deal with some stuff and you're not getting out of there until you do deal with this stuff, you could be sitting there a long time contemplating that until you finally come around and hopefully do it, or you run. We are not a lockdown facility. A lot of the kids are mandated that come through there, but we do have self-referrals and parents, you know, that ask their kids or bring their kids in because they need help. Not to be redundant, but I think...
Dan?
Yeah.
Representative Ross, what can you tell us about your success rate? Are you able to keep some records on the success of your... participants?
I actually could not. No, I'm not official enough.
Okay, Trish, are you?
This is Tanya.
Tanya, I'm sorry.
Fred.
That's Fred, I'm sorry. Are you officially from the S House?
Yes.
Okay.
And you want me to answer? I really can't talk to a success rate. I can tell you how many complete treatments. But we take kids from all over the state, and really I think the success rates lie in the outpatient programs that are doing the follow-up work. It's really hard to get data back on those kids because they get too far away. They move.
Thank you.
Anyway, just the other part I was going to say, I didn't want to get too redundant in talking about the money that goes into these programs as opposed to going into the criminal programs such as McLaren. For an example, the judge earlier was talking about how much money goes into keeping a kid in jail as opposed to putting a kid through a treatment program. I just personally cannot see how you can weigh, you know, one as opposed to the other. It's, like you said, a no-brainer to me. You put a kid through treatment, even if you're saying a 15% success rate, which I think, if that's including outpatient, that's not a good representation of the whole population as inpatient treatment goes. I think inpatient treatment rates are going to be a lot higher than that. And even if it was only 15 kids, you've got 15 kids that are not out committing crimes, using drugs, have a chance to live their lives and actually see a chance to live their lives, which a lot of these kids coming in do not see. And finally, with this allocation of money, I think that it would be a lot easier to attract better educated staff to the programs. I mean, I just graduated from the University of Oregon this past June, as opposed to most of my friends who did business communication, random programs. I make approximately $1,000 a month less than them. This is by my choice that I do this. That I work for this program is not my choice that I get paid that amount. But I know that I can't stay with this program for much longer because I can't afford it. And I think that plays a big factor.
Okay. Tanya, I'm sorry to have to do it, but I need to remind you of the 2 minutes.
Okay.
And I will respect that.
All right.
Okay. I don't have a lot of statistics. I do believe we need to invest in people, and although we heard really nice comments about Yes House, I think that we in this state know so much about adolescent treatment, and we're all trying to do it. And I think kids do take or do use multiple treatment episodes to get to where they get. We don't know when the miracle is going to happen, so we don't need to put limits on our investments, and that's just a personal philosophy. I'm the program manager for Yes House and Stronghold Cottage, which is a women and children's program in Corvallis. For the last 6 years, Yes House has worked with 500-plus families, and Stronghold Cottage has worked with about 103 moms and their kids. Drug addiction today is, as you know, ravaging our youth, our families, our schools, and our communities. The needs of the kids and families referred to us today are greater than they have ever been. The treatment field is responding to the crisis in a lot of positive ways. We've become better trained to deal with the myriad of problems our clients present to us. We've had to become experts not only in drug and alcohol, but in criminality, in violence, post-traumatic stress disorder, other mental health issues. We form networks and partnerships with community resources to better attack this problem and to work more efficiently for our clients. We're doing the best we can, but we do need some relief, and we need additional funding. We not only need to increase services for our clients and become more accessible to our clients, but we also do need to be able to pay living wages to the people who serve those clients. I think I did that in a minute.
Thank you very much. Do you have any written information on the outside that you could get to the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all for
all the questions.
Tanya, Senator Yee has a question for you.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
I know 10 years ago when the facility was started, the state funded about $500,000 for 12 pairs per year. And you indicated in your testimony that the facility needs more funding. So can you tell us what is the additional funding you're asking for and for what reasons?
Well, about 2 years ago, we saw a need, just not only in our community but statewide, that we needed more beds to be able to reduce our waiting list. And we opened a second house on a prayer and a wish. And our wish was that we would have been able to get 3 or 4 more beds funded in that facility, and that would have enabled us to give additional treatment to, say, 12 other kids. we weren't able to secure that funding. We're still wishing and praying every month that we meet the bottom line.
What does a bed cost in a year?
There are other very knowledgeable people in this room that can answer what that would be.
Is it about $40,000 per bed? That's how much it was 10 years ago, because I think you had about $500,000 a year for 12 beds.
And
also, will you be able to provide us some statistics about the success ratio of ES House? I mean, can you go home and look at the records? How many that are completed their program, and how many stay on for the 1 year follow-up care?
I know that our completion rate for an adolescent residential is very high. We can about 87.5 kids complete, 87.5% complete our program. And that's very high for kids.
And how many stay with the 1 year follow-up care?
Most of those who complete stay with the 1 year follow-up. It's about having enough time and treatment to learn the new skill and develop, I guess, the commitment for continuing care. And you just don't get that in 2 weeks and out or 30 days spin drive. It doesn't work like that for kids.
But if you have more information, send us some
video. Thank you. I'd like to call up Kathy Stromnig. Thanks. I'm sorry if I missed. Okay. Kayleen Deathridge. And Sheila North from DePaul Treatment Center. Kathy?
Cherokee Hub, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Strombay. The organization I represent is the Inter-Southeast Caring Community, one of eight caring communities in the Portland metropolitan area that work collaboratively with community members, service providers, local business, county and state government agencies, the faith community, and schools to help youth succeed in school. ODAP has played a major role in our coalition providing Oregon Together funds, which allow us to implement positive alternatives before, during, and after school activities, parent education, alcohol, tobacco, and other drug prevention, and the opportunity to engage the entire community in the lives of youth. Increasing funding to provide treatment for high-risk youth and families will, over time, reduce the number of youth entering our prison systems. Increasing funding for good family-based prevention will, over time, produce responsible youth who have the skills to make good choices about alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use. An ounce of prevention is truly worth a pound of cure. As a foster parent for a 12-year-old boy who has been removed from his parents' care because of alcohol and drug use, I see daily the impact alcohol and drugs have on children. Imagine, if you will, the first 12 years of your life with parents who are not actively engaged in each developmental stage of your life. Not teaching you proper social skills, not learning how to communicate when you are happy, when you are sad, when you are angry, not learning how to be responsible, to be normal. Then at the age of 12, to be taken away from the only world you know with negative survival skills in hand and being placed in a safe, loving, learning environment, one that will try to provide structure, boundaries, discipline, and nurturing, but not knowing how to cope with that. Having to take on a whole new identity at 12. Instead of being the person you were who acted out all the time, you have to learn to be like a lot of the other kids are. As a coordinator for the Inter-Southeast Caring Community, I listen daily to kids' concerns surrounding alcohol and drug use in families. We have a responsibility as a caring community to advocate for those kids that can't, to provide needed resources for families with addiction issues that will help them learn the skills to remain alcohol and drug-free. We have a responsibility to teach youth how to make the right choices. We need to remember that no one is immune to the travesties of addiction. As a caring community, our job is to work together to create and implement programs that reduce the risk and keep kids from being successful. I invite all of you to look at the positive results that will occur if funding is provided to implement prevention programs and programs that assist families to be drug-free. It truly takes a village. Thank you for having me here today.
Good evening.
Good afternoon. My name is Kayleen Deathridge, and I am here today representing Oregon Partnership. Oregon Partnership is a statewide nonprofit organization providing drug and alcohol information, education, and treatment referral services to Oregonians. Oregon Partnership works directly with community coalitions and prevention and treatment providers. Through the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program support, we operate Oregon's Drug and Alcohol Helpline. The helpline is a confidential 24-hour service fielding between 1,500 and 2,000 calls a month from people seeking information, confidential counseling, and treatment referral for substance abuse. Through our helpline database, we are able to collect information from our callers on alcohol and drug use. This information provides us with a broad picture of usage rates around the state and allows us to assist communities and organizations with prevention planning. Oregon Partnership has been actively involved in providing technical assistance and guidance to Oregon Together communities around the state as they work to create and mobilize their local coalitions. We have seen Oregon Together communities achieve great successes in their efforts to positively affect drug and alcohol issues in their communities. OADAP has recognized the need to support and train local coalitions and prevention providers to carry out prevention and treatment work. While these local coalitions put in a great deal of time and effort writing grant proposals to obtain funding, they continue to rely heavily on funding from the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to accomplish their goals. At this time in Oregon, we're seeing kids use drug and alcohol at younger and younger ages. Parents are struggling to educate their children and to prevent them from beginning to use drugs. We have a critical need to serve high-risk youth and families and to provide them with effective treatment services. We realize that dollars alone are not the answer to the state's drug and alcohol issues. However, OADAP plays a pivotal role in partnering with these communities to provide the funding necessary to facilitate the successes. Your support of OADAP's budget proposal will ensure that funds are available for communities to continue to prevent drug use and to promote healthy and drug-free lifestyles. Thank you.
Thank you,
Sheila. Good afternoon. My name is Sheila North. I'm the executive director of DePaul Treatment Centers, and DePaul provides services to both adults and youth in the city of Portland. We are one of five state-funded providers of intensive residential treatment for youth, like Yes House. We are funded for 12 beds by the state. We have 7 beds which are funded through Multnomah County. We have the capacity to serve 26 youth. I've been thinking about what I wanted to say to you, and I think I can throw a lot of numbers at you, but I'm gonna stick to these kinds of numbers. At the present time, DePaul has a waiting list of between 4 and 6 weeks for youth to be admitted to treatment. During that time, youth are either incarcerated or on the street or in their own homes. During that very vulnerable time that they are waiting for treatment, much happens to them. And an example of what can happen is the young girl who committed suicide recently off a bridge in Portland. We are unable to add beds because we don't have adequate funding. It costs between $160 to $178 per day to treat youth in our program. We receive about $95 per day funding from the state and a similar amount from Multnomah County. Without the additional funds from ODAP, I do not know how we can continue to provide such services. We have on staff a psychiatrist. We are running a program at DePaul for residents from OHSU so that they can learn about the impact of substance abuse on youth and what it looks like. At the end of this year, we will have our program will cost the agency in excess of funds we receive about $178,000. Those are the kind of numbers that I would like you to hear. We do not have the resources to do a long-term follow-up study on the youth who go through DePaul. We would like to. We will look for funds outside of the agency to do it. But it is not possible to provide those kinds of bells and whistles, so to speak, with the funding that we receive. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about that. But I do want to say again that the wait list that we maintain can result in dire circumstances for families and for youth, and the inadequate funding, it has an effect on the state. It ends, it results in kids in the criminal justice system, which is more expensive than treatment.
Thank you. I guess I would have a question about how, if there was more funding for this particular program, how you could quickly have enough beds to serve the people that need the help.
Well, with adequate funding, we can add beds. We have actually 30 beds in our facility. We have funding for 19 at the present time.
Okay, if there are no other questions of this panel, we'll, what I'm going to do right now is call those folks that are more than 100 miles from Salem. So, Rodney Clark, Lucy Zaminelli, and Rita Thanks. Sullivan.
Hello, Rita.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for the accommodation. It was a long trip,
sure.
4 o'clock this morning.
I was down at this sign-up sheet and saw some people were from more than 100 miles. So.
Madam Chairwoman, committee members, I'm Rodney Roadrunner Clark. I'm a Klamath tribal descendant. I'm an attorney who's practiced law with Indian tribes in states of Oregon, Idaho, and Nevada. I'm actually here representing three different constituencies that asked me to come here. One is the board of directors of Klamath Alcohol and Drug Abuse. Second, I have a formal letter delegating me the responsibility to speak on behalf of all of the Indian tribes and Indian programs in the state of Oregon. And as of last night, the Klamath County Justice System asked me to speak on their behalf. I may take a few ticks longer than 2 minutes, but out of all due respect to the people asking to speak for them, I do respect the audience, but I need to respect people asking to speak on their behalf. My remarks are primarily addressed at my fellow conservative Republicans. I find myself in the unusual position of being an attorney who's been running a social program for 7 years, and I do not ordinarily have support for spending public dollars on social programs, frankly. However, I am four square behind this proposed appropriation, and I've got very practical reasons for doing so. It's going to save money, and I'm not going to say that you can capture the money right now. I think the fallacy in that argument is the number of people who are drug addicted and alcohol dependent are growing. We're making inroads and we're saving money, but it's not a steady state situation so that the numbers remain the same, and when we reduce the numbers who are dependent or addicted, therefore we've got an immediate savings. We're making inroads, but it's not a tit-for-tat situation. From the tribal perspective, all of the tribes in Oregon at this point are tired of being federally dependent, want to not have only tribal governmental self-sufficiency with family and individual self-sufficiency. It doesn't do any good to have a government that's financially healthy if your people are dependent. And drug and alcohol is a tremendous drain on the tribal population and our constituency. In terms of Klamath County, we have put together, I think, just about the most effective continuum of treatment care, particularly for the criminal population in the state of Oregon. It would be impossible for us to gather data on completion, because we don't do things that way. We have a continuum of care, so that if somebody is not progressing in treatment and not being accountable, we transfer them to more intensive level of treatment and make them more accountable. And if they're not accountable in that way, they wind up being put in jail. And if they wind up in jail, our motto is no escape from treatment, so we treat them in jail. We're doing it with next to no money because we're ambitious and we bring in federal dollars. The county is timber strapped, and is one of the timber depressed economies and doesn't have any money to put into drug and alcohol services, so we'll compete for federal funds and beat out New York and Detroit, Chicago, to get the money to serve our people. We are not touchy-feely. We don't care if you were breastfed, if you're a criminal. We care about your thinking errors and cognitive restructuring and stripping around your thinking before we start giving you treatment, and we have been effective.
We also had the number one rated proposal in the country for a drug court. We've got a drug court going, so we're getting people early on in the drug and alcohol treatment field. I would put to you that Health and Human Resources has moved a long way from what they used to do. I heard beer and wine tax earlier when we, all you heard about were waiting lists and needs. And most of the testimony is not about needs. It's about practical good business sense. If we've got people on the SCF caseloads and the AFS caseloads, and by the way, Klamath County led the state in reducing AFS caseloads, and maybe there's a little capture there, in part because of our effective drug and alcohol treatment. If we can reduce those caseloads, we can reduce the cost to the state of Oregon in running government. And drug and alcohol treatment is necessary to reduce those caseloads. The same thing goes for the judicial system. The state of Oregon pays $28 a day per bed for a residential program. You can't stay in Howard Johnson's for $28 a day. Never mind provide treatment, recreation, food, and all of the other things necessary to turn people's lives around. Tomorrow, I'm going to drive straight back, so that's why I appreciate being allowed to be up here a little earlier than I'd anticipated. I'm driving straight back because we have 8 women graduating from a residential program tomorrow. These are 8 women who are in residential treatment in lieu of a year's jail time. All 8 have jobs. They have set up their own Oxford house, so they have their own housing. And I'll tell you, 7 of them, I'll bet you anything, will be successful. They won't be on the AFS caseload. They'll get their kids back from SCF. They're not going to be costing us money in the criminal justice system. They're not going to be an embarrassment. They're going to be taxpaying citizens. And I would think that's what we would all want. And in terms of, as a substitute for data, we've only been in operation as a residential program for 9 months. However, we have so many graduates who are in recovery and feeling good about themselves. We are putting on a powwow on June 19th, Indian and non-Indian, and you are invited to attend, and you can meet some of the people who are in recovery and see what your dollar will pay for in terms of pursuing this initiative. I think this makes good Republican sense, frankly, and I wouldn't be here to support it if it were a touchy-feely, needs-based, waiting list type presentation saying we need more money for this, that, or the other. This makes sense financially.
Thank you very much, Rodney.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members.
Okay, what I wanted to tell the committee is we'll all allow for questions after the panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, perhaps for the first time in my life, I'm going to steer away from talking about my own program, which I've been at for 21 years, and so it's very difficult. But I would like to be bold enough to try and talk about the system that you all have helped create and the impacts, and I think positive ones, that are going on as a result of system changes, and I'll do it very briefly.
Your name for the record.
Oh, Rita Sullivan.
Thanks.
The field has undergone rapid changes, and that's why I urge support of ODAP's budget requests. Because of the leadership in DHR and all the departments within it, where A&D is well integrated into the whole DHR system. And I think everyone sees that alcohol and drug treatment is an essential component of any plan to move people from welfare to work or from foster care into the parental homes. And treatment now is built on these linkages with other partners and other agencies. And in the private sector, we've evolved in very parallel ways to the DHR missions, the benchmarks, welfare reform, even federal Medicaid waivers, family preservation, reunification goals of SCF, employer mandates, school mandates, integration efforts. All of these indicate there is a clear recognition of the need for treating addiction before other services can be fully utilized. But with these, what I consider to be wonderful evolutions also increases the demand for treatment and a very different type of treatment. Years ago, beginning with these new views in DHR, we began on a journey to develop family treatment, very different. It was a paradigm shift. No longer saw the client as the user, but the client as the family. And with this came a shift from a punitive model to a supportive one. But these new models demanded treatment goals which went far beyond abstinence. the playing of essential roles in moving families onto self-sufficiency, family reunification, reducing drug-affected babies, developing affordable housing. And these collaborations are now moving strongly into the medical community. The complex and difficult, time-consuming effort it is to deal with addicted families are worth it when we look at the outcomes. But it requires intensive, specialized programs, programs that offer a full array of services, and I think they are represented in ODEP's budget package.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is the system is already overburdened, and it's attempting to respond to these changes in the system. We know now there are already more people needing treatment than are getting them. And to sanction people for noncompliance when there's no access to a treatment is just fundamentally wrong. The family models do not respond. They cannot be funded by a fee-for-service model. It is impossible to fund family treatment with Oregon Health Plan, for example, because the needs are so much greater than that. Sort of summarize by saying that the traditional treatment of seeing people for an hour or two in an office has been pushed aside for doing outreach, home-based visits, meeting clients where they are, doing different kinds of work, and I think it's represented in the ODAP budget. In summary, I'd say that research shows that children affected by chemical dependencies or other serious family problems will begin the use of alcohol or drugs before they enter junior high school. We must heal families, but how do we heal families in a system which doesn't pay for family treatment? This proposed budget will bring that in. How do you make comprehensive life changes which go beyond abstinence without aftercare, where those issues are dealt with after the stabilization of sobriety? This budget speaks to that. We have model programs in the state to treat mothers and fathers. The outcomes speak for themselves, but we don't have capacity. It makes no sense to keep pregnant women or women with children on waiting lists. The ODAP proposal addresses this issue. 10 years ago, when we began to treat families, we had to develop housing. We've been doing that for about 6 years, where we've been partnering with agencies to develop drug-free housing. This is a huge need. It is a relapse point, and it is addressed in the ODAP proposal. Lastly, I have held to the view that clean and sober families are the best prevention we can have, and the ODAP proposal addresses that. How do you meet the comprehensive needs of complicated families without case management, where you can go out and match services to clients? And ODAP's proposal addresses that as well. How do you know your approach is working unless you rigorously evaluate? I truly believe we need to fearlessly look at our practices and, based on lessons learned, either sustain them as best practices or evolve them into such. ODAP's budget proposal addresses this. In conclusion, I value all of the proposed programs contained within the ODAP proposal.
Thank you. Lucy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lucy Zamorelli. I'm with the Willamette Family Treatment Services Agency in Eugene. I'm here in support of the alcohol and drug office budget, and particularly in support of Governor Kids Heather's additional $20 million targeted to high-risk children and families. I work with teen girls and adult women, and I'd like to acknowledge some of the girls in my program. I'm on the back wall, Becca, and I'm going to share my testimony with one of the girls who's willing to speak with you. We set up the programs, but they do the work. What I know working with women and children is that today's high-risk young girls are the mothers of tomorrow's high-risk families. And when we fund drug and alcohol treatment, we're funding a myriad of interventions, child abuse interventions, criminality interventions, health interventions, domestic violence interventions, prostitution interventions. I could go on and on. I did bring some statistics. Just kept them in my bag at the last minute. I think that when we fund programs for kids and for families, we're not only affecting those children and families, but we're affecting the quality of life for all Oregonians. Children who go to school are going to be in school with children dealing with addiction. Children who go to the playground will be meeting kids who are dealing with addiction. Every step of the way, we're all one. We're all just people living in the state of Oregon. And we all have to live here together. And the more we can do to help people at risk, kids at risk, the more we do for all of us. I think we've already heard a lot of the different research and lots of different studies that show that treatment dollars save dollars. But I think it's more than just the dollars saved. I'm a Democrat. I think it's the quality of life. It's the quality of life that we present people with. So anyway, I did give you some written testimony, and I would like for Jessica to have a chance to talk to you a little bit about her her experience in recovery and in treatment.
Hi, I'm Jessica Lowe. Can you guys hear me? Anyways, I just want to tell you, we have a very good program at Willamette Family Treatment. We do need more funding. It's a wonderful program. I was in it before, and I did relapse, but I came back because the program did show me that I am allowed back and to keep coming back. And they've always been there for me. Treatment is very important. Most of the people, the teens that are addicted to drugs, and they're in the system and they're going to jail and stuff, mostly the problem isn't crimes, but their problem is drug addiction. And we need more funding, whether it's just for Willamette Family Treatment, but for the Yes House. I've heard a lot about the Yes House, other treatment centers, because that is mostly the problem. We have a lot of addicted teens. And I honestly, in my life, since I've been a teenager, I have not met one group of teenagers that not like five of them haven't been using. It's a very big thing that's going on, and I can tell you from experience, it's we really do need a lot more funding, and please,
Jessica, you think you need more funding because the adults are telling you that, because I don't know how you would know that you need more funding.
Okay. How I know that we need more funding is because we're losing beds. I went to Skipworth, and it took me forever to get in, and that's fine because that taught me something, but it's like we're losing beds because we had more beds the first time I came in. We don't have a lot of money for rec. I mean, we have $25 for, like, six kids, you know what I mean, to go out, and we get one day a week to go find something clean to do, you know, something that's going to be good when we get out, you know. And it's like we're losing everything. We really don't have any funding. I know we don't, because it's not that I worry about my treatment in there, but I know about other things that's going on too, with the funding, you know, people losing their jobs and things like that, and it's a big thing, you know.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Senator Bryant.
Could you tell me your age?
Oh, I'm 15.
And when did you start using?
I started using when I was 11.
And what was your drug of choice at that?
Meth.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative, actually, what I said I would do is wait until the panel was done, and Representative Loken had a question that I put her on hold for.
I'm sorry.
Representative Loken?
Oh, thank you. My question is directed to the gentleman representing the tribe. You know, when you, and I'm going to give you the same question I gave another person who represented the tribe yesterday. When the casinos were started, I understood it was to help, you know, the Native Americans and the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I am wondering, as you voice your need for state funds, have you applied to the Indian casinos for some help? They are very successful, and I would be surprised if you were not able to get some help from them.
Perhaps if I could give you some accurate information then. My program is a Klamath tribal program as well as a nonprofit program.
Mm-hmm.
The Klamath tribe did institute a casino a year and a half ago. We have yet to make a dollar from it. We're barely making debt, so there is no money from the casino. Not all tribes are in urban areas and therefore are making substantial amounts of money from the development of a casino. We're barely holding our own.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is primarily to create tribal employment at this point, because there just isn't the population to produce the kinds of revenues. Nevertheless, we've set up a drug addiction program and a gambling addiction program to deal with people who have gambling problems out of local resources without the tribe putting any money in to try to be responsible about social problems being created. I can't speak for the other tribes. I do know the Grand Round Tribe, who I used to be a tribal attorney for, put substantial amounts of money into both social programs as well as non-Indian programs in their areas of jurisdiction. But the Klamath Tribe doesn't have anything.
Yes.
We don't even have a reservation, so it's a little tested.
One more question, if I may.
Sure.
But isn't there, would they not help others, whether or not you're a member of the tribe, if you went to another tribe? Spirit Mountain has a very successful casino, and there are a number around the state. And are they prohibited from helping?
No. Tribes do help one another. For example,
okay.
Our tribe had the opportunity to purchase a multi-million dollar basket collection, an artifact collection that were originally tribal artifacts, and did not have the resources to do it. Among other contributors were the Calcutt Band, who do have a very successful casino.
Mm-hmm.
We are citizens of the state of Oregon. I would think it's also appropriate to go to the state legislature and support an initiative that's intended to help all of the citizens of the state of Oregon. I would also point out, notwithstanding being a tribal program, our program serves the entire community. We're responsible for most of the treatment services in our county, and the reason that Klamath County asked me to come up and represent their interests is we're not just viewed as a tribal program.
Mm-hmm.
The inadequate funding from the state of Oregon cuts across all bounds, whether it's tribal or nonprofit or community-based, and that's why I'm representing both constituencies.
Follow-up.
Representative Law.
I appreciate your comments. The state is limited, too.
Yes.
And there's no way the state can take care of 100% of the need. And so it's a matter of all of us joining together, unless we raise taxes to the ultimate, and not all of us can afford that. So I think it is a matter of the state doing what it can and then joining with others like tribal casinos, like various nonprofit organizations, and, working together to do this.
Good.
Whatever you.
Thank you. I have a question for the panel. We all support treatment programs, but do you have any ideas that would be a good prevention program? What can we tell the young students in school that alcohol and drug use is harmful for their health and harmful for their career? I mean, do we emphasize on health education in early grades? I mean, do you have any ideas what would be an effective prevention program that we can have?
I can say that, when adults came in to talk to me about it when I was younger, it wasn't the same as when we got an age group going. Teenagers came in to talk to elementary schools to tell them, what their past experiences and things like that. It helps a lot better because you're more close to the age and you just need, I don't know how to explain it. It's more just something that, we just need more. It's good to come in and talk to us about it, talk to the young kids about it and stuff, but it's got to be more close to your age group who's talking to you, and that, to me and to a lot of people I've talked to, it's more effective that way.
Another question, Madame. So you're talking about peer education.
Yeah.
The senior or junior high students coming to talk to you. At what grade would be effective? I mean, too early in the grade school probably would be too early.
Yeah.
At what grade would it be effective?
I would say junior high.
Oh, at junior high.
Yes, because I've talked, you know, my experience, I've talked to my brother about it, and he doesn't understand, and he's in elementary school as much as if I would talk to a junior high school student, because they're more close to age group. In elementary, they know that drugs are bad, and they, in elementary, mostly, you know, they're thinking, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. But in junior high is when they start moving up, and they're getting more involved in their community, which is their age. And that's when drugs start coming around, mostly.
Okay. In addition to the peer counseling, to the extent that you can encourage youth to dream, the big dream, and have a future, and have a vision of something you want to do with your life and something you want to be in your life, makes a heck of a lot of difference in terms of what you do today. And so if you say, if you've got somebody who says, I want to get a job, is nowhere near as meaningful as somebody saying, I want to be the president or a wildlife photographer or something tangible that is really felt in the heart, tends to help people stay on a healthier path.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call up, these other individuals are also 100 miles from Salem, so I want to be sure that they have an opportunity to speak. Bruce Piper, Joe Marmo, and Rick Jones. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just thought that little girl was sitting
on the testimony. Well, after we get the people that have been here, come 100 miles.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, my name is Bruce Piper. I'm from Roseburg. I come wearing a couple of hats. I, too, am part of the vast right-wing conspiracy. And I am the president of the Oregon Treatment Network, which I'm not sure about this, but I may actually be the person that signs more contracts to deliver more treatment services across Oregon than any other single person, which is a scary thought. And I am a board member of Uncle Valley Youth for Christ, which I have been a board member of for 16 years, and so bring an interesting perspective there. I want to share with you just briefly four outcomes. My comments will be very brief today in the interest of time. The first outcome, if I could have your eyes for a moment, is yesterday's Roseburg News Review. We now have a 19-year-old who is going to be the youngest death row inmate in Oregon, and he is a poster boy for why I'm here today. Jesse Fannis was someone that was born drug affected. He is, I should say first, I'm not the type of person that when I read the defense counsel's attempts to portray someone who commits heinous crimes as themselves a victim, you will find very little sympathy from me in that kind of a tactic. At the same time, I run a program that consistently treats women who enter treatment pregnant. In the last several years, we've had 53 infants born alcohol and drug free to women who enter the program using or drinking. That has resulted, I think, in a very good partnership with Services to Children and Families, has resulted in a lot of children who otherwise would be currently wards of the state who are not. And interesting, you may not have thought of this at all, but you might consider that alcohol and drug treatment is something that has a direct impact on the number of abortions. Women who are using, as has previously been commented on today, their sexual behavior, of course, is affected by that, and pregnancy is often an outcome. And one of the very nice things that I can sit here in front of you today and say is that women going through treatment have a life-changing experience in all aspects of their behavior. And so not only are infants being born alcohol and drug-free, but then they are also not being aborted in some instances, which personally, from my value system, is a positive outcome. A second outcome is that I've heard several comments today wondering about outcomes and how do we define success. And I would agree with you that there is at times a moving target in defining success. Let me define it in one way that nobody's done that today, and that is rearrests. A local corrections official 4 years ago told me that, and I you'll have to verify this, I can't, that the recidivism rate in the penitentiary system in Oregon was something like 65%. I don't know how accurate that is. If it's anywhere close to that, it's appalling. We have been running a drug court now for 3 years. We've had 80 graduates. We monitor arrests as the primary measure of recidivism. We monitor that through the state police law enforcement data system. They are connected nationally. Any drug court graduate who is rearrested, we know. In 3 years of graduates, we've had one rearrest out of 80 graduates. I think that's very impressive. I can't tell you how many of them may have relapsed. That would be a different measure of success. I can tell you that not very many of them have been rearrested in that three-year period. So consistent with what Judge Larson said, during the period that they're actually in treatment, and then many of them have been out for as long as 2 years, an awful lot of them have not, again, run afoul of the law. I'm pleased with that as a taxpayer. The last outcome I'd like to share with you is the issue of looking at the services that are funded through ODAP as a public experiment. Unlike AFS, unlike SCF, unlike Voc Rehab, unlike the other social services that are funded directly by Oregon, much of the alcohol and drug treatment system are private nonprofit providers. They are provided by people in the public sector made up by boards of directors, mostly business people at the local level, who have put in about three decades worth of volunteer work ensuring that a continuum of services is available. I'm very proud of my board and the business people that serve on it, and they are very committed to the kind of services that we've been providing for a long time, since 1971, actually. I'm very concerned that Oregon's experiment or pilot program using the nonprofit sector as the primary means of delivering these services is not doing too well. In the last several years, programs in Roseburg, in Grants Pass, in Coos Bay, in Klamath Falls, in Bend, in Salem, in Portland, have all closed. In some instances, some of those services have been picked up. Rodney, if he came back up here, can tell me he's picked up some of those in Klamath Falls. Others he has not. They've gone away. Senator Bryant can tell you personally that in his district, Central Oregon District Hospital and St. Charles Medical Center have both combined somewhere close to $500,000 buying a facility that I can contract for to provide residential and detox services. That program is on very thin ice, based on the reimbursement rates that we're currently receiving. So think about for a moment this $20 million as a means of continuing Oregon's experiment in providing services through a different mechanism, through the private nonprofit sector. Because, frankly, it's an unusual way of, generally speaking, when you look at the services that Oregon provides, of seeing those services. I, for one, like that. I hope that you would consider that this $20 million is in part a way to continue that, because I personally, after having been in this field since 1981, have never seen such demoralization among my peers and concerns about people leaving the field. We cannot compete with other social service entities funded by public dollars to attract personnel. We simply can't. We have people that come to us that we have via jobs. We are a jobs placement place. And when they are ready to be hired, in some instances in Voc Rehab, we can't pay the minimum that Voc Rehab requires in order to employ them. It's a pretty crazy situation. There are reasons not to do this $20 million. You know, if we want as a policy, as a state, to try to maximize the number of people in the PERS system, then don't do this. If we want to maximize the number of public employees, because what happens is as the nonprofits go down, increasingly the services are picked up by the public sector. Now maybe, and this is heresy for somebody in my position to say, maybe what we want to do in the long term is see that if our focus is on trying to get people out of their addiction. Because maybe the best way in the long term is to have these services provided directly by state employees or county employees rather than nonprofits. It's going to cost a lot more money to do it that way, but if we're not willing to put the money in small increments like this, in the long term we will, I believe, because it is such a problem we can't ignore it. And Judge Larson, you know, gave it some data about that, and there's a lot more out there accurate. That's the long term. We actually have programs represented in this room that used to be state agencies. They were spun off as nonprofits in the very late 70s and early 80s, are now nonprofits. I would encourage you strongly to seriously look at this as an investment in a system that I think we can be proud of is coming more from the private sector, and I, for one, would hate to see it revert in the other direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe?
Hello, my name is Joe Marmo. I'm from Newport, and I've been in the alcohol drug field since 1977. I've been in Oregon since 86. And I've been both on the treatment side and the prevention side of that. I'm speaking mostly, and I handed out, this is my handout here. I'm speaking mostly as a board member of the Newport Partnership Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse, which is a coalition in Newport in Lincoln County. The enclosures that I enclosed, I just cut these out of the Sunday Oregonian over the last week and a half. I think the latest one, or the one, the most dated one, is the last week of April. The first one, Troubled Teens Share Traits, I just highlighted a couple of things that struck my eye, and we're seeing a lot about alienation and rebelliousness, lack of parental involvement, and then the third one, that even violent antisocial teens responding to mentoring programs. The other two were just things that caught my eye because we're all interested in whether or not anything's having an effect. And we are seeing more and more data like this. This has to do with other states or the nation, but we're also seeing some good data from our counties, particularly from the community coalitions. Now, Lincoln County comes out data-wise as one of the highest risk counties in the state. Measured by the OADAP data gathering, having to do with risk-focused prevention and that sort of thing. And I've been a board, I was a member of the coalition and a board member in that since 1991. I listed mentioning that the statistics are down, some of the things we have seen in Lincoln County since the coalitions have been involved there, and we have four and at the most five coalitions we've had going in Lincoln County that are part of the state effort. We also have two or three other coalitions that have just gotten going because people have realized that building coalitions is a good way to go in our communities. But we've had for the first time a drop in the actual per capita liquor sales in Lincoln County over the last couple of years. We've had a corresponding drop in juvenile crime statistics and others and some adult statistics. As groups have been stumbling over each other to take credit for that, I'm not here to say that credit is due to one particular thing or another, but it is a trend. And I listed some of the things that in Lincoln County and concentrating on my group, that I'm involved with, we've been able to see policy changes instituted. And those of you who are familiar with the Seafood and Wine Festival, we've had people that were involved with the coalition key leaders who are also on the festival board and have two years ago, for the first time, eliminated underage people from attending the festival. Before, for 15 years prior, it was always billed as a family event. Also reduced the number, the size of the alcohol sample that served at the Seafood and Wine Festival. It used to be you could get big goblets of wine as a sample, and so we had a lot of drunk people creating a lot of problems. And that may seem like small things, but it took a lot of effort to do that. Correspondingly, members of the committee have been involved with policy changes in the schools, where we headed for a zero tolerance policy both in the middle school and high school. for violence and for drugs and alcohol. We have a, we have had a police liaison officer with the city police. There's been a lot of those kinds of things countywide as a result of citizen involvement. As far as programming, the young lady mentioned about peer involvement and the AWESOME program, many are familiar with, is a statewide program that actually has a curriculum that brings the older students down into the middle school to talk about all kinds of these things as part of the curriculum, and our coalition helps pay for that. In Waldport, which is another coalition, South County, they've opened a youth center. In East County in Toledo, they have several things going on that are really notable, but the one that I really was impressed with was a few years ago, the citizens group helped clean up public housing there. Public housing in Toledo had reached a point where there were basically a couple groups that had taken over public housing and were threatening everybody if they said anything. And working with the police and with the citizens there, they were able to form like an association. They got a policeman living in public housing. They did videotaping. They ran these people out of there. And now you go there to the public housing, and they've got programs. They've got kids playing out. And, you know, it's just it's real noticeable, the difference.
Joe?
Yes?
Would you mind if just kind of wrapping up so we can hear from the one other person
okay.
who traveled 100 miles before we close the committee?
All right. And then I wanted to mention drug-free workplace, and I won't describe that then in detail because of time, but I wanted to throw this as a curve out. The drug-free workplace committee looks at these types of proposals involved with economic development. They're having a heck of a time in Lincoln County coming up with drug-free employees. We've got 30% of our businesses doing drug testing, and sometimes they cannot. They'll have 20 applicants, and two will be able to pass a drug test. The last thing I wanted was noted was the number three was I'm also employed as the plan coordinator for Marion County under the SICA grant, state incentive grant, and having traveled around for the last 3 years and doing coalition work and that, I think that whatever you do with your money, you'll get a better use for it if you put some more teeth behind the collaboration that is we're trying to achieve through the SICA grant. And anyway, and that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could we finish the panel?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Robert Jones, Clinical Director of Grand Pat. We are the one of the few treatment programs actually that are supported and actually owned by a fully capitated health plan. And I'm sent up here to talk about that today. I sit here with a lot of emotion, actually, trying to decide which direction I want to go. I have many hats as I sit here. And I think I'm going to start with one in the interest of time. In 1976, I sat in this room as a patient in an inpatient treatment program in Portland. And the director of the treatment program brought me here with three other clients from that program. It's a program in Portland called Freedom House. So I've been absent from all mind-altering substances for 23 years. I'm one of those statistics that count. And I believe it's important to say that, and I say to the people behind me that those of us who are successful in recovery need to stop being quite so anonymous, because I think the folks sitting in front of me right now need to know that there are people with long-term recovery as a result of support mandates, as a result of treatment programs that were applied effectively and timely. Under the Oregon Health Plan, I have to get to the point because of the time. I work for 20 doctors, and I really like what I do. And the reality is that I wouldn't be sitting here, nor would I be the director of Choices Counseling Center, if we didn't keep people out of the emergency room, out of the psychiatric units, out of the suicide watch programs, and off the transplant list. Very interesting statistic that hasn't been mentioned here today is that about 80% of the people that we see in substance abuse programs right now, currently, are positive for hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For those of you who may not know much about hepatitis C, it is a very powerful, very quiet virus. AIDS is a wimp compared to hepatitis C. 60% of the new cases being reported right now are as a result of drug use. Not only because of IV, but also snorting. They've discovered discovered that we can transmit bloodborne pathogens through a straw if you actually injure your nose. I have actually had the privilege over the last 4 years to work with about a half a dozen folks who needed liver transplants. And in order for them to get those transplants, they needed to be involved in the treatment program and had some accountability because they had a history of it. I'd like to sit here and say that that's been really successful and that those poor people are all very healthy and supple today, but I actually have contact with one of them who is still doing very well. And those were very costly. I spent yesterday afternoon trying to get liver transplant costs, and I don't have accurate data, but when you look at $20 million throughout the whole state compared to probably about probably $200,000 to $300,000 process for one patient to get a new liver, and we all know that, alcohol and other drugs cause some serious liver damage, even without hepatitis C being part of the issue. The single most important thing that people can do who have been diagnosed with liver disease is to not drink alcohol or use other drugs, as far as they prevent the condition. So as a representative of a program that works exclusively with the Oregon Health Plan, I might say that we're in Grants Pass, which is a small community. Our little program, which is one of four, actually five treatment programs in Josephson County, we have 250 clients. So that's, I don't have to really go too far to get statistics. I walk into one of our groups and open the door and look in the room and see what we need. The last thing I'd like to say is something that I stole from a drug court judge at a conference in Sacramento last year. How much does the payment for the Christmas cost?
Representative Rob, one quick question of Jill. You said that it's important to put teeth into the program. Are you talking about who's to put the teeth in, and how do you mean that?
What I mean is that the state incentive cooperative agreement formed a cooperative agreement amongst agencies to cooperate in collaborative planning. And what we see, what I've seen in around the different several counties that I've been involved with coalitions, is that you've got a real mishmash going. In some places it's better than others and this and that. But I think if perhaps out of the governor's office or wherever it has to come from, that the agencies are much more impressed upon the need to come to the table together to do collaborative planning. We do know what works in prevention and treatment. And the more collaboration you see from your agencies who are dealing with these social problems and doing the planning, you will see much better programs come out of that, and you'll get a lot more for your buck that way. Right now, we still have a lot, the agencies still separately do plan strategic planning having to do with alcohol and drug services. The cooperative, the SICA grant is an attempt to bring all of those groups together to do cooperative planning for A&D prevention and along with the governor's crime initiative. But what I'm seeing is that it's a matter of enticing those groups together rather than making them get together, and I think we need to make them get together.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Yee, just a follow-up question. So what agencies are asked to work together on this program? Which agencies?
From my memory, there were some agencies that were required to work together, which would be the local safety planning committees, county alcohol and drug prevention. There was one other one, and then there's a long list of agencies that you would want to be involved, including juvenile and any of the agencies that are involved with dealing with the problems like the Children and Families Commission and Children's Services, and I can't remember the name of the one that does the welfare programs. Any of those agencies, you'll see, like there's budget items in most of those agencies that deal with prevention and sometimes treatment and related programs like family parenting programs and those types of things. And the more we can get in these communities, get these agencies together to do planning, I think you'll see much better coordinated efforts in really putting the programs where they're needed and also paying for the programs that are needed.
Madam Chair, is correction involved? Is Oregon Youth Authority involved in this cooperative effort?
Well, I think Oregon Youth Authority would be involved through the juvenile. But whether or not the adult corrections, I'm not sure.
I apologize to the rest of you who are signed up. I hope nobody else. My list doesn't show that anybody more than 100 miles, that has come more than 100 miles is still out there to testify. I do apologize. I tried to give warning prior that if we didn't move it along, we wouldn't be able to take everybody, and we have not been able to do that, and I do apologize for that. But I will leave the record open until 5 o'clock this evening if you would like to submit more written testimony. I thank you all for being here and testifying, and I appreciate those of you who are being more open about being clean and sober, because that helps us make our decision. Thank you very much. We will adjourn for today.